writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
Hello, and welcome to our very first podcast of Words to Write By. And we are really excited to have you here.
Yay, I'm excited.
Normally in this early spot, I think we'll just kind of check in and see what's going on with us. But I thought today we'd start by explaining why we're doing this.
Why are we doing this?
So Renee, how many writing craft books do you own?
Oh God, this is embarrassing. If I'm totally honest, I have over 50. Like I counted them.
About how many of them have you read all the way through?
If we're counting the ones that I read in grad school, it makes me feel like I follow through a lot more. But beyond school, I would say I've probably read through 5 of them, like all the way through from beginning to end.
I have at least 15 of them, and beyond ones taken for classes, I have read through exactly 1.
These craft books, there's promise in them. These craft books are promising a strategy or advice. They promise that you'll write that great scene or that killer description. And you buy the book expecting it to fulfill this promise.
We both don't want to just write a book. We want to write a really good book, like the ones that you read that inspire you to be a writer. And if I hold up one of those books, and then I look at my writing, there is a big gap. By purchasing craft books and reading them, I'm hoping to bridge that gap and get a little bit closer to these really wonderful books that I read.
Publication, of course, is a goal, definitely. But I write my book as if it's the only one that I'll ever write. I don't know why, but I do. I want it to be something that fulfills my potential. I wanted to be a reflection of my potential as a writer.
By the very act of going to the bookstore and picking up the book and purchasing it, you have already taken the first step to improving. But unfortunately, that first step doesn't get you anywhere.
Yeah, you get this high of buying the book and you've invested in this promise. But then it comes home.
Part of picking up a book is, since I can't take another class right now, or because I couldn't actually have this instructor, I'm going to buy a book and have it substitute for the class. And we were talking earlier about why this doesn't work. The biggest one being accountability. Like after you get done with the second chapter, no one says you have to pick up the third one and read it. And there's not any turning in of the exercises to prove that you've done them. And there's no test to make sure you actually understood what was there. You're on your own. And then the second thing that I think is just as critical is when you're in a class, you're surrounded by students that are all doing the same thing. And there's a community. And I really miss that when I'm reading a craft book, because like there's something really cool and I want to tell someone about it. But then I first have to explain everything that I read and explain what I thought about it. And by the time I get to that point, it loses the excitement.
When was the last time you read a life hacker article or learned a hack and actually used it? And if you used it once, that's great. Did you ever use it again? For my students, they know they're supposed to outline. They know they're supposed to brainstorm before they write an essay or talk it over with a friend, but they don't. Every time, I mean, they know it works because I force them to do it. And then the moment they're on their own, they refuse to do it. They just won't do it. It's performing the action that gets the result, not knowing the action. And somehow the result will be produced on its own. It's wishful thinking. It's what we want.
It's good intentions.
But it's not how it works.
One thing we want to do with this podcast is to read these books carefully, take notes, talk about what we've read, And finally, to actually do those exercises in the books. Our promise is that we ourselves will do those exercises. And if you want to join along with them, great. We'll try to figure out some way to share as a group and you're not just listening to us. That's our promise. And part of the reason we're doing this is because we want to do this.
Right. For me, I learn through teaching. I know if I want to know it, I should teach it. This podcast is my way of getting through these books, but also teaching it so that I know it. It's not just for you listeners. It's for me and the promise I made to these 50 plus draft books.
With that, let's get on to our very first podcast.
Yay!
In today's episode, we're covering chapter one of John Gardner's The Art of Fiction. We'll discuss what he means by aesthetic law, if reading the literary canon is worth it, and what the dealio is with all these he pronouns.
So chapter one of the book.
Yeah, that was a really interesting read.
Had you read this for a class before?
No, I don't even know who suggested it to me. I think it was a collective. They're like, have you read John Gardner's? Or, oh, this comes from John Gardner's, you know, book of fiction. You know, just that there's all these examples and people quote him a lot.
Is this one of the books that everybody has on their bookshelf, but maybe they never get around to actually reading?
I wouldn't be surprised. So why did you read it? Where did you hear about it?
You recommended it.
Oh, awesome.
Okay, so it starts off with this thing called aesthetic law. And you're the one with the literary degree. So tell us, what the heck is aesthetic law?
I don't even think he knows. His first point is he's trying to make, like, the first rule or the first law he makes about writing fiction. He says, every true work of art and thus every attempt at art must be judged primarily, though not exclusively, by its own laws. If it has no laws, or if its laws are incoherent, it fails usually on that basis. So for me, I think it means that there are no such thing as a set of hard rules that, when followed, will produce a perfect story. There's like no hard rules that, if followed, would make quote unquote good art.
There's no formula.
There's no formula. Yeah. Like people do, you know, if you can find a formula, he says, you know, it reduces down like the magic of fiction to, you know, almost like a caricature of itself and wouldn't really be able to be followed.
But he does say that you can do that for genre fiction, right? I mean, this gets right down to the whole idea of literary fiction versus the fiction that the common people read.
Right. The plebes and how they read. Yeah. I think for him, yeah, when he says that there's, when he talks about maybe a formula of writing, it's a critique like, oh, well, not good art, but, you know, oh, those genre fiction writers, they can write in a formula and it could be okay because you don't like formulas. So that's your way of dissing them.
So my issue whenever I go to one of these talks on writing is that you'll hear someone say, there's this rule and you have to do this. Or you'll have a piece of writing and someone will say, well, you know, you have too much of this in it. And the rule is that you have to do it this way. And the issue I come up with that is that often you go to the masters of writing, the works that everybody aspires to, and they totally break those rules. And so he comments that often a teacher will say, well, that's all right for Shakespeare, but not for a beginner. This idea that, you know, you have to learn how to write and follow all the rules. And once you learn them, then you can break them. But like there's some kind of magic sort of leveling up that you have to do before you're allowed to write how you want to. And I've always taken that to say, well, once you've actually proven yourself to be successful, people will let you get away with anything. But when they're trying to evaluate whether they want to take a risk on you to publish you and make money off you, they're going to put these rules in place to say, oh, well, if they break that rule, we don't take them. And what I really liked about Gardner was his comment that mistakes can be shown for what they are by analysis of how they undermine the fiction's intended effects. This meant that it's not that there's a rule you can't break, but there's a guidelines. The reason it's there is because when you break it, you run into other problems. My one that always gets me is people say, well, you're telling too much and not showing. They hold it up as like saying, well, I measured out your writing and there's this much showing and this much telling. And because the telling weighs a lot more, you have a lot more telling than showing, then obviously your story isn't any good. But what he's saying is that you need to look at the intent of the piece, and then you need to evaluate whether or not that particular bit of showing or telling works for the piece or undermines the piece. And what it means, I got out of this, is that when I'm critiquing somebody's work, I can't just fall back on saying, well, there's this rule, or your main character is unlikable, as much as saying, well, because I did not like your main character, I didn't feel for him when he got into the situation. Or because you're telling me all this stuff, I don't understand the voice of your character. I don't understand what's really motivating her. And I think that's a really useful frame of mind to take when we're evaluating our work and other people's work.
Yeah, no, that makes so much sense. In fact, in my classes, when I teach critical thinking, I teach fallacies, and there's a fallacy called the fallacy, which is someone has an argument and there's a fallacy in it. And you say, well, your argument is invalid completely and utterly because there's a fallacy in it. And it's like, well, there might be some merit to the argument, but you just don't want to like argue it. Or it's like pulling someone's spelling mistakes out. Well, you have nothing to say because you said, you know, you wrote your instead of you are, you know. It's a lazy kind of critique. And so, yeah, this the aesthetic law, the way it's broken down, it does draw attention to having to look at art for what it is and be able to interact with it for what it's trying to say, not just a set of rules that you can point to and say good, bad. I actually appreciate the idea that he brings out rules, but that they, it's not that so much that they can be broken, but that they are broken, and that it doesn't break the story.
The other bit of vocabulary he brings in is the canon. It's one of those words that once it's defined for you, you see it everywhere. But until that point, it's very nebulous. Basically, what most people mean when they talk about the canon or the literary canon is a bunch of dead white males. The problem being that there are lots of writers out there who aren't white, aren't male, and aren't dead, that have really valid and wonderful things they're writing. And should you just exclude them because they weren't from a certain period? But the thing you have to keep in mind is that part of the reason why we had the canon in the first place is because back in the late 1800s, professors of literature got sick and tired of only teaching British literature or European literature when they had all these great Americans that were writing great things that weren't included. And so they devised this idea to like include those American writers. You can think of a canon as if you just include more modern writers, people from different backgrounds, that you could also create this wonderful collection of good examples of all this different type of writing.
Yeah, the canon is kind of like a mixtape, like back in the day when you'd make a mixtape for someone that you liked. You know, this is my curated, you know, aesthetic. If you asked your best friend for a mixtape, you know, you would get the songs that they feel represent them, right? That they feel everyone should listen to because they're so great. If you asked your boyfriend or girlfriend or significant other, as opposed to your best friend, you're going to get a different set. Think of it the same way. These professors with their educations and their backgrounds, and they are certainly male and they are certainly white. Imagine who they're going to pick in their mixtape of what they think is the best literature ever. The canon, what we read now, what we consider great literature, has just been passed down to us by somebody putting together a mixtape of what they thought was great.
Do you think there are valid reasons to have a set of works that everybody agrees on are important and should be taught? Let's assume that you can be diverse and pull in new people, and you can actually have a body work that is representative and fantastic. And the idea is that everybody in their introductory English class should read this set of books, or everyone that wants to be a writer should read this set of books.
That's a loaded question. Now, that's a very difficult question. I don't think so, because so much work gets brought out so often, so fast.
If you were somewhat able to fix the exclusion part, and actually able to have, and you're actually able to say that you have, you know, Black and Native American and queer writers, and like you had something that was truly diverse and wasn't so, and somehow managed not to be so big that someone could actually read it. Would that be the best way to teach?
Who would decide this?
Well, this, because we're separating that out. We're separating out the real world issues, with just this concept that he's going by, which is that if you just do a scattershot approach and you just read whatever comes your way, even if you're picking out some fantastic writers or some things, because you're not part of a system, because you're not part of a curated set of works, that you're missing out as a writer or as a student of writing. You have the teaching experience here. Do you think you need to have a proper education with a canon to produce literate students?
Not necessarily. For me and my own education, not necessarily. I think that it really helps if you have some direction and if someone's pointing at something saying, this is how you find a theme. Here is an example of a theme. Here is an example of what people would consider good literature. This is why. And when you get that kind of instruction, that's going to inform how you write your own stuff to readers, because then you kind of have an idea of what readers like. Someone is saying it's good and they're telling you why, right? I don't know. This is such a complicated, like, I am happy that I read Shakespeare. I'm happy that I enjoyed it. I'm happy that nobody told me I was wrong when I was reading it and made me hate it like everybody else, you know, whoever else reads it. And a lot of people don't like it. I was given the fun stuff, Midsummer Night's Dream and Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet. Like, I was given the stuff that has fairies in it. I never had to read Julius Caesar. And if I had, maybe that would have turned me off from writing. But I also got to read fantasy books and sci-fi books. And no way would those have been assigned to me. And I had to find them on my own. Having a mix is definitely going to help. But there are self-taught writers out there. And yeah, without guidance, it's going to take you longer and you might quit, because after a while, you're just like, nothing helps. It's like, oh, darn, if you just had direction, you would have figured that out. The problem with Gardner, I think, is that he absolutely thinks that without it, I guess you would be a hack. I think it comes down to, do you need to have formal education in creative writing? No. Should you read these famous people? It helps. What do you think, Kim? Do you think you need to know this stuff?
I think that the more instructors that make a difference to you, the more great instructors, the more great mentors you have, the easier path is going to be. But I think that Gardner comes off as kind of arrogant to suppose that that's the only way. If you are writing this now, I would think that there would be some people around him that would point out that he's coming off as kind of arrogant and that he's going to turn off people reading this book.
Yeah. There's a passage. He says, no ignoramus. He likes that word. Ignoramus is pretty fun. No ignoramus. No writer who has kept himself innocent of education has ever produced great art. One trouble with having read nothing worth reading is that one never fully understands the other side of one's argument and never understands the argument is an old one. It rarely happens, if it happens at all, that a writer can achieve effects much larger than the effects achieved in books he has read and admired. Human beings like chimpanzees can do very little without models. One may learn to love Shakespeare by reading him on one's own. The ignoramus is unlikely to have done this, but there is no substitute for being taken by the hand and guided line by line through Othello or Hamlet.
So I think the other thing we need to point out in this book, something that was very obvious to you and me reading it, is the fact that he exclusively uses the pronoun he, and he chooses male writers to describe. And I actually was looking for any point in which he might allude to the fact that there were female writers out there. I got one reference to professors, that people could have good male or female professors that guided them, but I did not see any reference to female writers.
So far, we're on chapter one. True. It doesn't look good for the X chromosomes. They're the losing team. I've done some research online and everyone complains about him using the he pronoun. I get it. This thing was published in 1983. Stuff was different back then. It's not like we can't get that. But you know, there was stuff written back then that was not this bad. This seems quite intentional. He is so focused on the importance of the canon and what should and should not be taught. He is clearly aware of his pronouns and he is clearly aware of what he is doing.
Do you think that will detract from the message?
Depends on what the message of the book is. In the first chapter, you're not really sure. I don't know if I got the message of the book yet.
So we're kind of on a wait and see. And we get to the end. If he's earned it despite using the male pronoun all over the place, then we'll give it to him. But like, we're reserving judgment.
I don't know. Are you reserving judgment?
Well, I think that if I get too ticked off at the writer of a book, I never actually finish it. So I'm going to have to give him a pass for right now and see how it all plays out. Because otherwise we won't get to the end of this book. And I'm kind of curious to find out what's in it. Because, you know, as you said, a lot of people refer to other people to read it.
Right. And I mean, he thinks he's got the chops. He's clearly got opinions about what is good and what is not. So maybe he's got some good advice. I don't know. Sometimes I think I have a high threshold for stuff like this. It's like, all right, I've read all this old stuff before. I've taken British canon like any, you know, literature undergraduate has. And I read it and I'm like, okay, yeah, he pronoun. I get used to that. I mean, it seems a little excessive in his case, but, you know, I'm willing to tolerate it. I'll tolerate that older teacher that clearly kind of breaks the line sometimes, and or any elder person sometimes they'll say sexist things, and you know you're like, okay, I give you a pass because you're in your 80s, but you know that 30-year-old, nuh-uh, he doesn't get a pass, right? I mean, I don't know, maybe this is just other women in their mid-40s and we're all kind of like that. But I will say I have abandoned books in the past that have taken it too far. I don't always forgive people for that, but I guess, well, we've committed ourselves to reading through this, so we have no choice.
So the one last thing I wanted to bring up, and this is something I noticed, is that part of the reason why he is so enamored of the canon and of a formal education is this idea that writing is less about one's experiences outside of writing and more about what one's read and what one has practiced writing, the craft of writing. One finds, for instance, naively excited and lengthy discussions of ideas that are commonplace, who have long been discredited, or one finds curious, quirky interpretations of old myths, interpretations that, though interesting themselves, suffer by comparison with the myths, with what the myths really say and mean. And then he talks about an example, like if someone writes a story about Penelope as a grudging, recalcitrant wife, the writing may be superb. But when we think about Homer's portrait of the true, perfect wife as courageous, cunning, and devoted as her husband, Homer's version so outshines the new one that we almost turn away in disgust at the new writer's work. Which is one of those things that when linked to his comments about the he pronoun and the male, is that basically the idea is that no, a woman couldn't tell the story of Penelope nearly as well as a male, as Homer did. So why even bother? Obviously, you knew exactly what this was all about from a woman's perspective.
Right, because he knows exactly, you know, what a perfect wife should be. Yeah.
And the other little bit of irony is that the thing that Garner is most famous for in his actual work is his interpretation of Beowulf, written from the monster's perspective. Huh.
So it's okay if he does it.
Or maybe it just goes back to this whole idea that really there aren't rules.
Right.
There are suggestions, and yet great art breaks those suggestions.
So there's this thing I do tell my students, and it is a cop-out. It's my way of getting around something like this. I tell my students when it works, it really works. It sounds great. But when it doesn't work, it crashes and burns. It's awful. And sometimes you just don't know. So you think just because another writer did it, it should work, and it won't always work. And you think it's never been done, you're not supposed to do it, and you do it and it's amazing. You can't predict how it's going to go, but just be prepared, as Bukowski would say, always be prepared for the possibility of total defeat, whether the reason for that defeat is right or wrong. So yeah, maybe that is what he's saying. There's no rules. I also took it as him like giving a disclaimer for this book. I don't know how many craft books were out there when he wrote this. Like, I haven't done a lot of research on the craft book of writing and
the history of the craft book in the late 20th century.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I don't think Alfred Lord Tennyson had a book besides other examples of literature and poetry that were guiding him. The Romantics had their little clubs. So at least they had like workshops, right? with each other. But, you know, I don't know if there was a book out there that said, hey, this is how you write a plot. You know, it was just like writers reading other things and then emulating them and copying them. And it could be maybe this is early in the history of the craft book. And he's just trying to say, hey, whoever you are, reader reading this book, don't expect to get like this set of rules that's going to make perfect literature. You're not going to get that in this book because there's things perhaps out of your control or perhaps within your control that I'm not going to be discussing here, that I can't. This is not a substitute for an education in creative writing, nor is it a substitute from all the hours and books of reading these famous authors. Maybe it's just a disclaimer. I don't know.
I think that's a good ending note for our first discussion. And now we're going to turn to a common element to most craft books, the exercises.
This episode's prompt or activity comes from John Gardner's book, The Art of Fiction. At the end, it's in the exercises section. This one is on page 197. Number 4, cooperatively list the customary elements of one or more of the following: a gothic romance, a murder mystery, a yarn, a TV situation comedy, a western, or some other popular genre. What are the philosophical implications of each of these elements? For example, the traditional ghost story includes, among other things, some old remote building, an emphasis on weather, especially wind, cold, and dampness, a restless animal like a dog, a wolf, owl, or bat. What do these elements seem to mean psychologically? What are some possible symbolic meanings of the ghost's return? The genres listed above are all quote-unquote popular. That is, their appeal is usually just adventure or entertainment. Suggest ways in which one or more of them might be elevated to serious fiction. For instance, might ghost story conventions be used to explore the relationship of an independent, domineering mother?
Was this written before or after Psycho?
I think actually after. He wanted it to be 100 years ago, dude. I think he thought he was in the wrong era to be a writer.
Anyway, we decided not to take any of the examples he gave, and we are going to do our analysis on the superhero genre.
Da-da-da. I think the key here is that he wants it to be elevated. So you can't just make a regular Marvel movie. You would have to list the tropes, but you want to think of ways in which it can be elevated.
So Renee and I took some time. We talked about this, and this is our answer. So the superhero genre.
Yeah.
I admit I'm a bit of a fangirl on this stuff.
I have watched the movies multiple times.
What are some customary elements of the superhero movies?
Well, there's powers.
Obviously.
Obviously, there's secret identities.
There's the superhero names.
There's conflict, inner conflict, some kind of flaw that intercedes on the power.
Part of the superhero shtick is that some aspect of their flaws are mirrored in their powers, or some aspect of their strengths are mirrored in their powers. And therefore, you have a, what would you call it? Externalization?
Yeah.
Of their inner psyche on their powers.
There's the origin story. Mm-hmm. Like where and how they got the power.
Yep. And that often links in with the where their name came from, what their secret identity is, what their costume they wear is.
The costume, the mask, what made them put on the mask? Definitely.
I think we're going to discuss costumes because that's a good detail to go into. I think that since Gardner proposed this activity, that general audiences have become a lot more savvy. The movie and TV studios actually recognize that the audience is a lot more savvy and a lot more receptive to a deeper examination. One of the superhero movies out there is The Incredibles. There's that whole take on the no capes.
No capes.
And the fact that it's a fashion designer that is designing the suits. It's all sort of a commentary on what fanboys would discuss about whether or not superheroes should have capes.
Geeks are fickle, and they really played that up.
But even there, I noticed there's a moment in that movie, which I've seen several times, where the kids get their suits for the first time. They discover them in their mom's luggage. And there's just this delight on Dash's face when he sees this costume and he realizes that he, in fact, will be a superhero. The movie itself is about how people should live up to their abilities, even if it puts them outside of mainstream expectations.
It's also about family. And family identity. You know, the teenage daughter, she's got her teenage complex of wanting to you know, separate herself and her own identity from the family. You've got the annoying brother who just kind of wants, I don't know if he wants to go his own way, but he's starting to like discover himself within the family.
So that was more of a family drama. What other superhero movies do you want to talk about?
Well, there's Logan. I saw it 3 times in the theater. I think was one of the best superhero movies I've ever seen.
Why would you say it was the best?
It really, I feel, took that superhero genre to a new level. For me, it tackled a lot of themes that pushed Wolverine's character. I watched a talk by the director, and he patterned that film off of an old Western called Shane. If you watch Shane and then you watch Logan, you see these parallels of someone who is both a hero, but an anti-hero in the act of survival. What is someone willing to do? You know, he's about to lose his identity. He's aging. He's an aging superhero that's rickety, and he is tired, and he can't do what he used to do. And how do you retire as a superhero?
And how do they use the costume in that movie?
It's interesting because he does not have a costume. He wears regular clothes.
So would you say that it's even a superhero movie at this point, if basically they're borrowing from the Western genre and he doesn't have the tropes of a superhero movie?
Yes. I mean, he has his powers. And he's still got his, you know, a wound, his emotional wound that is rooted in his powers. He's the same character, but he has been put in a different place. So putting him in a different environment, in a different set of circumstances, I think still makes it a superhero movie. Just a gritty one.
I think that simply because it's the most prolific of all the superhero franchises, that the Marvel Cinema Universe is a really good example to look at for costumes and for tropes, because they've both presented the tropes and then they've been able to play with them because everyone's familiar with them and they can kind of invert them. I think that the 2 costumes I find easy to discuss are the Iron Man suit and the Captain America costume. So the Iron Man, Tony Stark doesn't have any superpowers per se. He just has these incredibly powerful suits. And he doesn't have just the one. He often has multiple ones. Most Iron Man movies actually have a central plot of him building the suit out of whatever parts he has available. In a way, Tony's superpowers is actually his brain, that he's so smart that he can create the suits.
Yeah, he's an entrepreneur, but a super smart one with lots and lots of money.
Right. But when he actually builds the suits, he never has the money at those points.
Right. Yeah. His money can't save him at that point. He's got to rely on his own wits and his own intellect, which, like you said, is kind of his superpower. So if we apply this to the exercise, right, let's look at Iron Man. Like you say, it fulfills the trope of the costume where he's wearing a creation from his power. And in the first Iron Man movie, there's 2 suits. There's the fancy, shiny one, and then there's the one he makes out in the desert.
As Gardner was saying, you know, a suit can be more than just the plot device. There's a psychological aspect to the suit where Tony, the entrepreneur, starts off the film as a pretty big jerk. And it's through the suit and him becoming a superhero that he actually becomes a decent person and becomes a hero.
Right. And that is reflected in the suit. He's got this really crappy suit in the desert that he has had to create with the help of someone he's harmed, maybe inadvertently, but he's no longer in that safe car with cigars, private jet, right? He is like in the desert trapped making this suit, and it comes out really funky looking, right? But it's through the making of the suit and the purpose of the suit that makes him a hero.
So psychologically, the suit is both Tony Stark's salvation. The suit gives him the powers to actually affect the world in a way that he, as just a rich boy entrepreneur, cannot. But at the same time, his suit becomes a crutch. When he is Iron Man, he is this hero that does all this great stuff, but at the detriment to him personally as a human being. I think the best example of this is when Pepper comes home one day and Tony's sitting there in the suit and talking to her, when in fact, he's down in his workroom.
Typical. That is a total reference to Dr. Manhattan, in The Watchmen.
A much less PG rated version.
Yeah. The MCU is more like a PG-13.
Right. PG-13 is the new PG.
Right. So he's like the, you know, he's selfish in the beginning. He becomes the creator of the suit, but he's also the creator of his own problems.
All the Iron Man movies address the personal growth and the struggle that Tony has. Continually with Iron Man, we have the building destroying, losing, and regaining of the suit as plot devices, but also as psychological personal growth.
Oh, yeah. In that part where he does abandon the suit at the beginning of the final film. It's like a choice, right? I am choosing the family over the suit. But then he picks up the suit again, and then he dies.
And then there's the Captain America suit. And I actually went online and I tracked down all the different versions, because even though you kind of think of it as just one suit, in fact, like every time Steve Rogers shows up, he's wearing a different suit. When you look at Captain America, he is literally wearing the US flag.
He reflects America and the status of America at a certain time, like his origin story. In the beginning, it's World War II. And obviously his costume is going to reflect the style of the time, but it is literally the flag. But if you go a few movies in, it's more muted.
Right. With Captain America, you can actually see how he symbolizes the way Americans see themselves, the way Americans have acted in the world. By that measure, we're raising a trope to something that's actually symbolic, something allegorical, possibly. Because when the government's corrupt, he has a much darker suit. When has a clear good fight against the Nazis, because you can't get anybody worse than Nazis, it's Old Glory and it's perfect, most pristine form. So we've gone through the exercise, and what do you think we got out of this?
Well,
other than having a great conversation.
Well, I mean, I think there's something to be said for analyzing something that you think might be obvious, but is not. Just the idea of analyzing it and pulling out the pieces of a trope is important. I think this is a good exercise because nothing is ever original. When you're writing a story, you're going to write something that's not like no one's ever seen it before. It's like if you're going to write a memoir, well, someone's already written that. You're going to write a coming of age memoir, someone's already written that. Right? There are certain tropes to a coming of age memoir. I wouldn't have a title like coming of age. People have expectations when they read, and when they don't get met, people get angry or they put your book down. But if they get exceeded, that's where I think you've hooked a reader. And I think that's what this activity kind of does, is you identify the tropes, the expectations a reader has, but go beyond them. And that's how you get a very successful superhero franchise.
But considering that this is all about the art of fiction, and Gardner spent the whole first chapter about talking about the canon and all these great classic storylines, why do you think he basically gave people the chance to analyze a bunch of popular culture, which he sometimes refers to as trash?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, Kim, because if you look at the text, you know, there's some punctuation in here that might be lost on them. For example, in the activity, it says, the genres listed above are all quote unquote popular. That is, their appeal is usually just adventure or entertainment. Suggest ways in which one or more of them might be elevated to serious fiction, right? So if we're looking at his word choices here, he's got quotations or marks around the word popular, and he qualifies fiction with the adjective serious. So he's clearly got a judgment here where he doesn't think popular fiction, which are these tropes or whatever, are good in one way or another, which is weird because they become popular from the canon he's pulling from.
And I would argue that something like a comic book universe is probably more fiercely discussed than Homer is these days.
Yeah. He clearly has a value in classic literature. He thinks it's better than popular literature. I'm not going to even engage too much in that conversation because I don't try to qualify things like that. They exist in different spheres. They're different genres. It's different things. You're analyzing what you like, but it doesn't mean one's better than the other. Gardner clearly thinks one is better than the other.
And yet by the inclusion of this example, he actually allows us to indulge in analysis of much more popular entertainment, stuff that we'd be much more likely to write in.
But I also feel like he's asking us to engage on it on his level. I think he's trying to convince us, see how garbage this stuff is and look how much smarter you are like me. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe I'm being judgy here.
Okay, so we listed a whole bunch of tropes that superhero genres have, and we welcome our listeners to write down some of your own, or if you want to give examples of the ones we've listed in our comments section at the bottom of our page. And also because we had several other tropes to examine, we have recorded a second podcast where we just go over one of my favorite tropes in the superhero genre, which is that the good guys fight each other. So if you're interested in hearing this, you can go over to our Patreon site and subscribe to get access to that podcast. Okay, I think that's the end of our first podcast. Yay, we did it.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you'd like to support Words to Write By, please subscribe or leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or whichever service you use to listen to podcasts. And if you really like us, we've set up a Patreon account. Patreon is a service you can use to support artists and creators through monthly contributions. For just $2 a month, you can listen to additional recordings, like our analysis of the good guys fight each other trope of comic book movies. You'll also have access to our forums. Tune in next week when we tell you what we think of Gardner's classification of genres in Chapter 2 of The Art of Fiction. Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smiga-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
Yay! It's kind of weird because it happened in so many different sections that it's weird to think that this was just one podcast, but it was.